Okay, so I wanted to start with this picture of where I think that true democracy or the potential for genuine democracy in society lies. You'll notice that it's not fucking Joe Biden or Anthony Albanese up there. It's actually the currently attempting to unionize Amazon workers in Alabama, sending in the midst of this, their struggle to democratize their workplaces in some way, sending their solidarity to the absolutely brilliant and heroic uprising going on for democracy in Myanmar today. So I think, yeah, we should keep these sorts of instances of international working class solidarity in mind when we're thinking about, yeah, democracy and how we can actually achieve it today. So yeah, my talk is about why society is so undemocratic. And it's basically a Marxist critique of the state. So I think that, yeah, two very important concepts for socialists to get their heads around are those of the state and the path towards achieving democracy. I think our understanding of the state is actually a fundamental question for socialists, and it is also for other people who are seeking to change the world. There's questions like, is it neutral? Can it be welded for our interests to bring about genuine democracy? How do we challenge it? And do we need a state at all? And I think that your answers to these questions will fundamentally impact your political strategy going forward. So if you're new to socialist politics, you might not be 100% convinced that the state is actually an obstacle to democracy. So, you know, after all, we're constantly told that its existence is actually potentially the very expression of democracy. And actually, even Karl Marx began his career as not a revolutionary, but a radical Democrat writing for a liberal newspaper on how to reform the state. And I think his kind of journey is instructive for us as well. So it was his commitment to uncovering the path towards true democracy that drove his political development. So through serious interrogation of the state, class, capitalism, he was convinced of the need for a revolutionary socialist politics to overthrow the farce of liberal democratic capitalism once and for all. So I think, yeah, counter to right-wing distortions associating Marx with authoritarian regimes like the USSR and North Korea, Marx actually spent spent his life as a political activist driven by his commitment to thoroughgoing and collective democracy. He wanted to see a world where the laboring majority who produced everything would rule rather than the parasitic minority who lived off of this labor. And he concluded that the international working class that I was talking about before had not only the will, but the collective power to overthrow the minority capitalist class. And in so doing, they would be able to liberate all people from the scourge of class society. So his Marxist pursuit of political emancipation and a world organized on the principles of true democracy led him to reject reform of the capitalist state and embrace a politics of self-emancipatory revolution. Following the heroic uprisings of the Paris Commune in 1871, and that's a session I'd really like to plug for people tomorrow if you're interested in what, you know, a sort of incipient worker state might look like, should definitely get along to that session as well. He concluded that the working class cannot simply lay hold of the ready state, ready-made state machinery and wield it for its own purposes. Instead, workers would have to smash the bureaucratic military machine of the state in order to rebuild society anew. They would have to replace bourgeois representative democracy with their own directly democratic institutions of power. So in this talk, I'm going to explore why I think Marx and others were right about the capitalist state. I think the capitalist state is a thoroughly limited and even farcical kind of democracy. And I think that the state, far from being a neutral arbiter of equality and democracy, is actually one of the key institutions curtailing the possibility of achieving pure democracy. So as a little run through of what I'm going to go through in this talk, I'm going to explore the different aspects of the state, the repressive and bureaucratic aspects and its so-called democratic features. I'll look at some of the reasons the state is actually so important to capitalism, and I'll explore why democracy is often curtailed, even under the most liberal states. And to wrap up, hopefully I'll have time to offer some ideas of what an alternative to the capitalist state, which would be a workers' state, might look like. All right, so to begin, some definitions. The state, what is it? So in Lenin's brilliant book, The State and Revolution, he explains that the state is an instrument of class oppression. I think this is really important. At its core, the state consists of what he called special bodies of armed men. And for someone new to these concepts, I think this can be a bit confusing. Like, surely there's more to the state than its repressive aspects. What about the courts, the parliament, the bureaucracies? And I think you'd be right to consider those examples important parts of the state. But fundamentally, even bourgeois political sciences consider the state monopoly on violence a defining feature of the capitalist state. So if you've ever taken a politics course on the question, you've probably heard of the widely used definition of the state as a polity that maintains a monopoly on the legitimate use of violence. But why is this the case? Why is so much repression necessary? In the origins of the family, private property and the state, Engels, who was a longtime collaborator of Marx, explains that states have not existed for eternity. Instead, they are a product of a certain stage in history where society has become entangled in an insoluble contradiction of classes with conflicting economic interests. So as Engels put it, the state is, as a rule, the state of the most powerful, economically dominant class, which through the medium of the state becomes also the politically dominant class and thus acquires new means of keeping down and exploiting the oppressed class. Thus, the modern representative state is an instrument for the exploitation of wage labor by capital. So in other words, the state, as socialists understand it, is a product of irreconcilable class antagonisms, which compel this organ into being as an instrument of political rule by the economically dominant class. So Lenin describes the state as a power which arose from society but places itself above it and alienates itself from it in order to convince us of its class neutrality. The state moderates class conflict so that society can function without being consumed by endless conflict. But this order that it facilitates is actually one, it's not neutral, it's one that's defined by and in the benefit of the dominant class. The order of the capitalists inevitably butts up against the diametrically opposed interests of the working class. So when the capitalist order is rejected by those oppressed by it, the state's coercive apparatus is the most important last line of defense against those attempting to change things. So while states may project a facade of equality and neutrality through their parliaments, legal systems, bureaucracies, newspapers, etc., to achieve the consent of the masses, what really underpins their power is their repressive function. And I think that's why Lenin and others define the state as a power that mainly consists of special bodies of armed men. All right, so with that said, I want to move quickly to a key question concerning the state. Can it ever be neutral? So socialists think no. The state as a product of class, it's a product of class antagonisms and is proof of their irreconcilability. There's no neutrality in the class war. Only one side can win. The state is an organ of class rule. It's an organ of the oppression of one class by another. So it does not reconcile. It's not a mediator because it can't between the two classes. It dominates one to maintain the rule of another. So the state has a monopoly on making laws that benefit the dominant class and a monopoly on the use of armed force to enforce those laws. Because the rule of capital depends on class division and the rule of private property, this class division, not class neutrality, is structurally embedded in the state. So to explore this further, let's take a closer look at not just the repressive, but also the bureaucratic aspects of the state to see, unpack how they work to maintain the rule of the capitalist minority over the laboring majority. And I would add that this in itself is an inherently anti-democratic type of rule. So first, the legal system. So the legal system comes from and is enforced by institutions of the state. Its basis is the protection of private property or capital and the capitalists who own it. Laws upholding property rights are really important under capitalism. So the philosopher Jeremy Bentham argued that property and law are born together and die together. Before laws were made, there was no property. Take away laws and property ceases. And where does property come from? The theft and exploitation of the working class who do everything and produce everything in society. So we can think about this more concretely. Because the law is an instrument of class rule, class differentials impact the implementation of the law or your experience of the law. A common example is if you steal from your boss, the weight of the law will be used against you. If your boss steals from you via wage theft, for example, they're unlikely to even be investigated by the police. Another example is when workers strike for better pay or conditions. The police, a major part of the state, are there to beat them back into work. But when capitalists want to close a factory and workers strike and occupy to keep work going, the legal system and the police are yet again there on the side of the bosses, shutting down work this time and arresting workers. The class bias in the law is also evident in the fact that it's basically illegal to strike against bosses in Australia. So instead, workers are expected to argue their case before industrial courts and an arbitration system which determines wages and conditions on the basis of business profitability and international competitiveness. In a system based on protecting capital, the more you own, the more protected you are as well. So not only can you use your capital to protect yourself from accountability by paying for the best lawyers or whatever, but the sheer fact of someone's economic importance often discourages capitalist institutions from disciplining other capitalists, lest this shake the economy. So I think a really key example of this is the global financial crisis. Corrupt banking practices caused the crash that devastated hundreds of millions of working people's lives. Yet it was these same corrupt bankers who were responsible for the crash that were bailed out using public money. In the name of saving the economy, the working class instead was made to pay via extreme austerity, pay cuts, homelessness, and plummeting living conditions. So much for the democratic principles of accountability, fairness, and rule of law. So another key argument legitimizing the legal system under capitalism is that it is, you know, an arbiter of justice via the principle of equality before the law. This is meant to ensure a fair society. You know, we're all disciplined by the same rules, but, you know, in front of the courts. But legal equality is blind to social inequality. The celebrated French author Anatole France wrote, "The law, in its majestic equality, forbids the rich as well as the poor to sleep under bridges, to beg in the streets, to steal bread." Social and economic differences exist before the courtroom, and the structural blindness of the law to this inequality serves to further entrench it. Hence, the most dispossessed in society are the most likely to be incarcerated, with Aboriginal people making up 20% of the national prison population while constituting around 3-2% of the population. Meanwhile, the real serial killers, the real rapists in society, like John Howard, George Bush, and Joe Biden, walk free amongst the most privileged circles. They are rewarded with extreme wealth. Oh, wait, is it there? Oh, I missed a picture of George Bush with Ellen. They are rewarded with extreme wealth and celebrated or rehabilitated even by the liberal media. So finally, as proof of the democratic checks and balances of the state, we're told that judges are independent mediators of the law, existing as a check on parliament and other state agencies. But I think in practice, these unelected officials are independent only from the working class, while bound by a thousand threads, in Lenin's words, to the ruling class. In practice, they almost always rule in the interests of the rich and powerful, and this conservatism comes not only from their privilege and class position, but the constitutions which they hold up, which they uphold, which are the constitutions, after all, of property owners. So Marx argued that private property needed to be done away with to achieve equality, as it was already effectively done away with for the vast majority who own nothing but their ability to labour. Last night, Aaron argued or reminded us that 2,153 billionaires own more wealth than the bottom 60% of the world's population. Under capitalism, this crime of inequality and wealth achieved through theft, warring, destruction of the planet, and exploitation is legal. So upholding this criminal order and legitimating its violence through law is the true practical function of the legal system under capitalism, despite all claims to justice, neutrality, and equality. All right, let's move now to the related issue of the police. So as explored earlier, the police are the repressive enforcers of this criminal and undemocratic state of affairs. They are meant to uphold law and order, but we should be clear that this law and order is the law and order of the capitalist class, where private property rules above all, not human need. So it's no coincidence, I think, that things like white-collar financial crime, performed often by the middle and capitalist classes, are hardly even regulated or punished by the cops. It's crimes of poverty, so shoplifting, fare evasion, homelessness. These are the things that cops spend most of their time policing. And even without resorting to repression, resorting to violence, I think the mere patrolling presence of the police, which is really important, it's something that disciplines us into respecting the sanctity of private property. Workers have no interest in this system of alienated labour and producing for profit. And there's more of us than there are them. So to stop us from simply organising society differently, to stop us from striking, taking over workplaces, protesting to disrupt business as usual, requisitioning the empty homes, sharing the food that is hoarded by the supermarkets, the list is endless, the state relies on the police. And I think this is their real role, not safety or social services. So we see this important role they play when they evict the poor in service of landlords who own multiple properties. We see this role that they play when they punish the hungry who dare to take food from wealthy corporations like Woolworths or Coles. As the brilliant Black Lives Matter uprising last year showed, the police are far from purveyors of justice. They are defenders of a system of oppression and are necessarily inculcated in the worst ideas of that system, like racism and misogyny. We see this in the way they murder Black and Indigenous people with impunity, and we see this in their appallingly high rates of domestic abuse and the way they systematically fail victims of sexual abuse, including, you know, even members of the ruling class or of the upper classes, like Christian Porter's accuser who committed suicide. So though members of the police often come from the working class, they are trained to feel distrust and contempt for ordinary people. This suppresses feelings of solidarity with the working class. Structurally separate and above those they exist to control, the police are an institution of the ruling class and have to be understood as our irrevocable enemies. Everything about their job, from suppressing strikes and protests to targeting minorities for persecution, pits them solidly against the working class. Then there's the army. In situations of extreme threat to capitalist rule, the army can be used to serve a similar role as the police. Now, most of the time, the relationship of the army to the state is that it serves the interest of the ruling class overseas. The wars it wages are never about humanitarianism or democracy, but are about securing the interests of capitalists in one nation against those of others. But in France, during May 6, 1968, as a wave of mass strikes threatened the whole social order, the army was stationed outside of Paris, ready to intervene, and the army was put on standby after the sacking of Gough Whitlam in 1975. Famously, in the United States, the army was called out to deal with protesters against the Vietnam War, infamously resulting in the killing of four students during the Kent State Massacre. So there's photos up there of these different instances. Now, these repressive parts of the state are nakedly undemocratic. They're coercive. They force us into, you know, doing what the ruling class wants us to do. But I think no power can rule smoothly on the use of naked force alone. So the state has the sort of elements of the state that help breed a sort of consent to their rule. The state provides us with services like education, healthcare, welfare, And this can convince us that, you know, maybe the state does really care about the interests of its citizens. In reality, I think these aspects of the state are mostly means of ensuring workers can continue to be exploited smoothly and as efficiently as possible. So it's no good training up a workforce if they're too tired, sick, or uneducated to work or to continue working. And when we do win benefits from the state that it is unwilling to give, like increases to the minimum wage or health and safety regulation at work, these are always concessions to struggle, usually by the working, organized working class. I think we have to be clear that the things we win are never benevolent gifts from on high. Then there's, you know, education. So at state-funded schools, we're trained in the discipline, obedience, competition, and basic labor skills necessary to go out into the workforce when we graduate. It is a different story, however, if you're at a private school where I think you're inculcated in the born-to-rule attitudes of the ruling class that breeds such contempt and entitlement towards ordinary people and the oppressed. So, you know, we can look at the scandals of the elites in Australian Parliament today. Christian Porter is a pretty prime example again, because, you know, he raped his victim not while he was in Parliament. He raped his victim when he was a 17-year-old, elite private school boy who felt like the world was his oyster and he could do whatever he wanted to those around him. Meanwhile, there is the punitive and woefully inadequate welfare system, which I think exists to humiliate, surveil, and discipline the unemployed back into the workforce while paying out, you know, the absolute bare minimum to stop people starving in the meantime. And this, woefully inadequate welfare system is particularly inadequate in Australia. It's worth highlighting. Our welfare payments are the lowest in the OECD, barring those in Greece. All right, so the state, the capitalist state, using a mixture of coercion and consent, disciplines us into accepting the capitalist order. But how do we square this analysis with the existence of Parliament? Surely this is one part of the state in which the working class gets a say over the functioning of the state, an equal say guaranteed by the principle of one person, one vote. I think a closer analysis of power, true power in society versus Parliament helps us understand why Marx dubbed it the parliamentary swindle. So first of all, there are the blatantly farcical and undemocratic aspects of parliamentary politics, like gerrymandering, where politicians choose their own voters by drawing district boundaries, and the influence of and corruption of corporate lobbying. There's also the fact that politicians can literally lie to get elected, and according to the rules of Parliament, there's nothing that we can do about it but wait multiple years until the next election to kick them out. In a class divided society, Parliament also claims to represent everybody. But I think it's important to understand that electorates, the people who represent us and their electorates, are divided along geographical and not class lines. So in Adelaide, where I'm from, this means that one elected MP covers an area that incorporates the poorest and most working class, as well as the richest and most privileged, who probably, you know, are the ones that exploit their labour and have a direct interest in that exploitation continuing. There's also the fact that elected parliamentary bodies function as mere talking shops, as Lenin calls them. It's unelected and often shadowy, highly powerful and faceless bureaucracies who carry out the administration of the state with very little oversight or control by ordinary people. And these are chain and command agencies where the senior public servants, so people like very well-paid heads of treasury, army generals, police chiefs, ambassadors, legal officers, ASIO chiefs, etc., have a very powerful sway over the day-to-day government, business of government. And all of these are thoroughly committed to capitalism and the rule of the rich. As unelected representatives of capitalism, their independence from Parliament means they act as a check on unruly representative figures who try to undermine key aspects of the system. But even if all these obstacles were to be done away with, I think the most important part that undermines Parliament's claim to deliver true democracy is that it just doesn't control the most important section of society, and that's the economy. So production and the economy, the most important and fundamental features that shape the society we live in are completely beyond any pretense of popular control. So while elected politicians control the limited sphere of parliamentary politics, the rich, who control all productive and financial apparatuses of are the ones who control the productive and financial apparatuses of society. They own the things that we need to make society function. So examples are things like telecommunications infrastructure, electricity companies, office buildings, mines, factories, transport. And this is where true power lies. The rich get to literally shape the world around us. So you can think about it concretely. They make the decisions about whether we'll live surrounded by this lifeless, unaffordable, air-conditioned sky-rise, like glass monstrosity, like greenhouse, they act like greenhouses, like these air-conditioned monstrosities. Or will attractive, creative, sustainably designed buildings at a cost affordable for all be built? Will the natural landscapes be devastated by craters for mining, or will ancient ecosystems be sustained and nurtured? So it's the control, their control over resources that we use and the world around us that gives the capitalists enormous power, and that power lies largely outside the sphere, outside of government's sphere of influence. So we can think, of the example of Facebook recently blocking our access to news in Australia. In protest of an attempt by the government to extract some money out of it. So you see who has actual power to shape the world around us when it comes down to it. So in our capitalist so-called democracy, the people have no say whatsoever over the most important decisions in the world. The economy is the private concern of the bosses, and we have to live with their decisions. No matter who's elected to parliament, the capitalist right to hoard empty properties remains. No matter who is elected, the capitalist right to dig up fossil fuels and pollute the planet for profit remains. And no matter who is elected, they remain at the mercy of capitalists. Capitalists are the ones with the ability to control production, and capitalists are the ones who can mobilize enormous financial resources to disrupt and mold the economies politicians are elected to manage. Thanks. All right. So by now you might be thinking, this is all well and good. I'm, maybe convinced that the army, the legal system, the police, the state bureaucracies, they're all things that are outside of our democratic control. I hope you can see that the democratic ideals espoused by liberalism don't extend to the workplace, which, most of us would know is essentially just a dictatorship we're in 8 hours every day. And maybe, you understand that we have no democratic control over production, so we have no say over the way the world around us looks. But a lot of people, obviously with the rise of Sanders, Corbynism, all these reformist projects, are asking, why doesn't Parliament at least try to change this state of affairs? Couldn't some left-winger get elected and try to challenge the power of the capitalists in the interests of the working class? So I'm just going to quickly run through some obstacles in this strategy for challenging capitalism. Well, first, there's the fact that all the other parts of the state act as major limits to Parliament's ability to challenge the status quo because they're structurally committed to the ongoing rule of capital. The legal system, the constitution, the police, etc. They're all there to protect capitalist rule and, defend any attempts by parliamentarians to change that. But beyond these obstacles, I think there's just the simple fact that parliamentarians have no interest in challenging this state of affairs anyway. So you can think about the fact that their power and electability is directly related to economic growth and low unemployment. Governments rely on corporate taxes and domestic business to provide the economic base from which their own international and domestic influence can be strengthened. So this really compels governments to create attractive conditions for business in their home country to encourage investment in their state over another somewhere else. So if you can't already guess who loses out in this equation, it's the working class. The economic growth parliaments pursue come directly from working class exploitation. To maintain this dynamic, parliamentarians actually become the key arbiters of class oppression, expanding the state's repressive forces while attacking living standards, social freedom, unions, and any other institution that might, give the poor some confidence to resist the rule of capital. So I might just skip some stuff because I'm running out of time. We can talk about, I've got some photos up here about examples of ways that the capitalist state has resisted attempts at reforming it in the past. Maybe we can talk about that in the discussion, like the sacking of Gough Whitlam in Australia in 1975 and the Pinochet coup in Chile in the 1970s as well, which ushered in decades of dictatorship and neoliberalism. All right. So I think that the key thing that having illusions in reformism does is neutralize, disempower, and disempower social discontent. So an example is the incredible Black Lives Matter movement in the US. By the time the elections in America swung around, the street protests had actually largely died down, and people's energy had been redirected into parliamentary maneuvering and canvassing for votes. So parliaments in advanced Western capitalist countries are used to perpetuate the illusion of democracy, not extend true control over society to the majority of people. Today, as in the past, they use and distort universal humanistic slogans that we're all equal, that governments derive their powers from the consent of the governed, to rally the majority, the working majority, behind a system that really serves only the capitalist minority. So quickly, a final question I wanted to look at before I wrap up is the question of whether we actually need a state at all. So you might know that socialists, unlike anarchists, argue that we do need one, albeit a very different and ultimately temporary one. So why is it that we take this position? Well, I want to emphasize that the state exists because we live under a class society. So under capitalism, the state exists to defend private property, repress the working class and unions, police people's personal lives, and persecute the oppressed. As socialists, we actually want to abolish the state along with class relations. So like anarchists, we do actually want a stateless society. But unlike anarchists, we don't think you can get one immediately after overthrowing the capitalist state in a revolution. So states, as explored before, are instruments of class oppression. And socialists argue that the workers' state, which would be organized along entirely different, genuinely democratic lines, will be necessary to suppress the bourgeoisie and crush their resistance. So you can think about it. The capitalists, the judges, the generals, the police chiefs and top public servants don't disappear because you've overthrown their state. It's absolute insanity, I think, to believe that they would meekly accept the revolutionary will of the people. They will fight back militarily, through sabotage, and any other means at their disposal. So upon smashing the capitalist state, workers will have to suppress this counter-revolutionary minority while expropriating their wealth and control over productive resources in order to begin making society anew. So as with the capitalist state, therefore, the workers' state will be an organ of class rule, of class oppression, but now it will be the majority of the population suppressing the minority and not the other way around. Those doing the work that shapes society and makes society run would make all the political decisions about what production would look like. Schools would be run by teachers who work in them, hospitals run by health workers. Without an exploiting class running society, the enormous productive capacity of society could be put towards actually meeting people's needs. And workers are a collective class. This is really important. Once in control of productive resources and their labor, the working class would have to collectively and therefore democratically get on with the task of deciding how society should run. And I think democracy is key here because without the agreement and cooperation of the majority of workers, nothing would get done. The organization of the state would be very different. A bottom-up network of councils would be necessary. All of this, and we can go more into what that might look like in the discussion. All of this makes the workers' state qualitatively different from the capitalist state. This state would exist to defend the democratic gains of the workers against capitalists, and it would wither away, as Lenin says, and lose all repressive functions once the threat of counter-revolution is eliminated. All right, so to sum up, the working class relies on the democratization of all parts of society in order to function. The capitalist state requires the absolute opposite, a minority competitive class dominating and undemocratically leveraging their control of productive resources to rule society. So when we're seeking to understand why the state today is so undemocratic, we have to recognize that only the self-emancipation of the working class, only genuine socialism creates the basis for a society built on the principles of true democracy. A world run by workers would be one where need, not profit, is the driving force of production. With the workers of the world organized finally as the ruling class, we could extend cooperative, collective, genuine democracy into all spheres of life. The capitalist state is necessarily anti-democratic, and I think only a revolutionary movement of workers and the oppressed, organized from the bottom up into their own grassroots institutions of power, can rid the world of the scourge of bourgeois society and liberate humanity from class society altogether.